Welcome back to another episode of RMV.
Hey everyone, I hope you're all having an amazing day.
Today, we have Mr. Sanjay Mathur with us, who is a cybersecurity expert and also the founder and CEO of Frictionless Security.
Thank you so much for joining us. So can you please start off by introducing yourself, beginning with your education background and then about your professional career?
Sure. Hi, so my name is Sanjay Mathur, as you heard. And I'm originally from India, studied there. Most of my life I was there. So for some strange reason, I studied mathematics for 16 years. So I did my master's in mathematics from IIT Delhi, which is Indian Institute of Technology. So one may wonder why I went to a technology institute to do my mathematics. And this was mainly because I was very much interested in operational research and statistics. And the labs there were really good at that point in time. I'm talking about, you know, just move backward about 55 years back. We had very little choice of, you know, colleges there in India. And so I was a little bit privileged. And also, by the grace of God, I was doing well in my studies. So I was able to get into that. So I did that. After that, I did my management from my hometown, Lucknow. Which is in Uttar Pradesh, UP. And then I was working in India. I did a couple of things and then I joined TCS, Tata Consulting Services. That's where I became a formal programmer. They taught me programming. I learned during my studies, but not like, you know, professionally. So I learned there. And then I became a programmer. I was a programmer for probably 8-10 years, did a lot of coding. We used to call it coding at that point in time. And then I moved to Singapore. From there, I went to Australia, and from Australia to Silicon Valley. And then my quest kind of ended here. And then last 30 years, I am here. So that's my short story.
Wow, yeah, it's so interesting. You traveled to so many different places. What was your favorite place out of curiosity?
So my favorite place where I lived was outback in Australia. About 100 kilometers northeast of Adelaide, a small town called Wyala. It's not on the map, so if you try to look it up now probably it's on the map. When my parents looked it up, they didn't find it, and the nearest town was Port Augusta. So I went there. There was a steel mill at that point in time. I went there and we did some conversion from a IBM based, you know, programming to Burroughs based, you know. So we did a lot of, you know, programming conversion and testing and, you know, and user acceptance and stuff like that. So I lived there, and the thing is that there is no water there. It's arid. And yet I had my perfect 2 years of my life, and my daughter was born there later on. It was fantastic to live there. Yeah.
That's really cool that you went to so many different places, and like coding too. I feel like everyone knows coding now because it's so common. Like every kid is like, if you ask a second grader, he's like, oh yeah, I'm in coding classes now. So definitely. Yeah, so we wanted to start the discussion about cybersecurity. So do you want to share what cybersecurity is and a brief introduction about what cybersecurity really is.
Cyber is, you know, is the word, you know, is for the greater, you know, worldwide web and what is happening in that cyberspace, which is kind of a hyperspace that we have created. And like any other space, cyber also has its own threats, its own vulnerabilities, its own, you know, risks, if you like. So in the earlier time when we were traveling by train, for example, our parents used to guide us that, you know, you should not talk to strangers, or you should not take food from strangers, or you should not do this and that and so on. Likewise, in the cyberspace, we also have certain rules and regulations. And the thing is that they are very soft, and not everybody understands it, what are the dangers and so on. We all get attracted by it. You know, Instagram, TikTok, I mean, beautiful things, and, you know, Facebook, and like what we are doing currently. In our time, this was unheard of, you know, like we couldn't have this kind of Zoom session. So everything is great about cyber space, And it is creating a lot of collaboration opportunities, you know, stuff like that. But then there are dangers there. So cybersecurity is related to the science and art of defending yourself and conducting yourself in a secured manner. May you be an individual, may you be a student, or may you be a corporate citizen. I mean, the cybersecurity is kind of a must for everybody. So if I can differentiate, information security is something that you do internally to kind of beef up your defenses. And cybersecurity is something that external threats. So you need to understand what the threats are and how they behave. So it's a little bit different, although there's a lot of commonality between information security and cybersecurity. Yet they are two sides of the same coin.
So you have been part of working at cybersecurity for a long time now. It's like that's been your
So I have been working on the information security side, and that too, how to mitigate the risks. So that was my forte. And then about 10 years back, I joined KLA Tencor, now which is called KLA Plus now, a fantastic company, a great company. They called me to look after their global security. But one portion of that was, so there were two things that I did not do before. One was intellectual property protection, and second was cybersecurity. These are the two new elements that were added to my portfolio. So I can say that for the last 10 years, I have been pursuing cybersecurity, but that was not my core competency, if you like. I kind of developed it over the period of time. And that's something which is a good message for, you know, students, that, you know, you should not box yourself in one area. You know, things kind of grow.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, I was going to add on saying, yeah, actually, on your LinkedIn account, I saw that you worked at Visa, and my dad is actually currently the technology architect at Visa. So he works along with the Visa security. So I wanted to ask a bit about your experience during Visa.
Yeah, Visa is another great organization. I mean, it's fantastic. And my association with Visa was, I was working on a risk framework. And I presented it in one of the, you know, professional body meetings. And there was one lady who was from Visa, and she was at that time chief architect of information security. And I just presented, and then she said, you know, she came to me and she said, you know, this would be very beneficial for Visa. So I said, okay. Then she said, would you mind presenting it to my staff? I said, no, a pleasure. So I went there and I presented it in front of a bunch of, you know, maybe 8 or 9 people. And they tore apart the whole thing that I was presenting. And they asked me thousands of questions. And then in that process, I defended my stance. And so it was very simple. I can share it with you. The idea was that, you know, risk assessment has always been very technical. And I wanted to take it to the business side. So I created some very simple structure where I would ask a set of questions to business owners and then do a technical evaluation of risk. And that was something, again, I'm talking about maybe 20 years back, 15, 20 years back. And that time there was this great divide between business risk and technical risk. Not only divide, there was kind of a broken line between the two. I was trying to, kind of join those things, and it was difficult. And so anyway, we had this discussion, and one guy who was heading the security at that point in time, John Morey was his name, very nice guy. He's still active and you can look him up. So he said, why don't you join us as a contractor? So I said, okay. So I started working there as a contractor, and then we tried to implement it. And I tell you, it was the most difficult thing for my life, because Visa was not ready for it. But after some debacles there, finally we were able to implement it partially, and we could showcase it and so on. And then I was there to automate the tool which I created. So I probably was there for 2 years, and then they said there is a 2-year rule. You can't be a contractor anymore. So I said, well, fine. So what do I do? So I said, fine, I'm going out. They said, no. There's a position in internal audit, and you should look into it. So I never did audit. I did assessments. But then this was an opportunity. I just took it. So the lady who appointed me, she said, you know, you have to become certified within 6 months. I said, okay, certification. Okay, it's easy. So I got certified. Then I was there for 7 years.
Oh wow, yeah, that's really nice. Yeah, my dad works at Visa, so like I was like wondering what your job was there too, and it was really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, so Visa is very, very nice company, and because they are a financial company and because they have so much of compliance pressure, their security taught me, you know, I would say a lesson or two. So I learned, you know, a few things there, and which I'm still using. Some of the stuff that I learned from Visa, I'm still using it. I did a lot of audits there. So we were traveling. I was going to places like Brazil, China, India.
Wow.
Canada. So I was part of Visa International, and later on became Visa Inc. So I saw that merger, and then after that I left. There were two or three. I'm talking about the depression time of 2000. So there were two or three downsizing activities. I endured those, survived. But in the third one, I think they asked me to leave. So I said okay, I leave. So, and this happens in tech world all the time. You may be doing the best of yours, you know, and yet you have to come out. So that's another lesson that I learned.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, so what is a career, like what do you exactly do when you get into cybersecurity? Because there's so many different parts, right? So
cybersecurity world is now becoming quite formal. Earlier, it was like anybody who could spell it or who could understand it could come and say that, you know. But now it has become like a formal, discipline. So, and there are certain gates that you have to cross to become a cybersecurity expert. So there are some certifications, there are some kind of experience that you should have. So basically, if you look at it, there are some people who are called threat analysts, the people who can analyze the threat very well. And they are the people who look out. So they are looking out and they try to understand the tools and techniques these hackers are using. And there are certain patterns, and most of the defense tools that we know are quite applicable there. So you understand what the psychology of the adversary, why they are attacking, what is their motive, what are their tools, what are their standard practices. So these are the people who analyze that. And then they create the patterns, if you like. I mean, these are like design patterns or we call them threat patterns or threat, attack patterns. And then attack doesn't happen like somebody comes and snatches a chain and runs away. It's a planned attack. So you get a time. So these people are creating those intercept points, if you like, that here is your opportunity to defend yourself. If the hacker is going this way, then you should do this way. You know, kind of maneuvers which a standard defense personnel would do. So some of the learnings are coming from there. So they are threat analysts. They are people who are internal looking, and they are creating what they call the blue team. So they are blue team members, and these are the people who are trying to defend from a good person's point of view. These are the good hackers, and they know the tools and techniques, and they are trying to do that. Then there's red team people. Red team people are attackers. They are friendly attackers. So when you want to test your defense, you want the attacker who is on your side, not on the other side. Because then this attacker will actually help you beef up your defenses. So these are red team people. And then they are what we call SOC analysts. So Security Operations Center, SOC. And so you have analysts there who are looking at all these things, what all is happening. So one step back, earlier the information security was too heavy on prevention side. How do you prevent the attack, right? It was initially very heavy. So that's why you have firewalls, you have all the other things. So you are basically fortifying yourself, saying that if you're outside, you're not trusted. If you're inside, you're trusted. But not anymore, because I am outside, but I'm talking to you. And right now, both of us are vulnerable to cyber attacks because, we are out and about. There's no perimeter here. So these are the people who are looking at all the operations, what is all is happening. And they are trying to find out the kind of out of ordinary or what is not acceptable or something, a pattern which could be attack pattern. So there's a lot of noise, like there could be some attacks, some patterns that can be constituted as can be thought as attacks, but they are not actually. They are just abnormal behavior. So these are the people who are trained. So these are analyst people. That's why they're called analysts. So they are looking at what all is happening. They are trying to correlate the events, looking at the log and saying that, okay, this is a pattern which is very usual. So Sanjay Mathur logs in 8:30 in the morning. He has never logged in before that. He always logged in from this IP address. Now today, he's probably in the coffee shop, but the coffee shop is in 2 mile vicinity, so it's probably okay. And so on. I mean, they just do all this analysis. And then you have got security architects and designers. So you have cybersecurity designers, cybersecurity architects. These are the people who look at the defense and say how. So one thing you would appreciate is that, you know, you have the front gate in your house for people to come in, but hacker doesn't come in from the front gate. The hacker finds another, you know, wherever he can find or she can find, will come and attack. Now the thing is that you need to understand how the hackers are behaving. So there's a carrier now which says that how to think like a hacker. And these are people who are sitting outside and saying, okay, if this is what the vulnerability is. So these are the people who are, there's a term for that, which is kind of escaping my mind, where you have got this kind of events where you ask kids from all over the world to participate and they become hackers and they attack. They are actually also cybersecurity professionals, if you look at it. They are doing cybersecurity testing from outside, right? So there's a term, so you can say, you know, they are for the booty or for the award, but they are the people who are constantly attacking and they are trying to find out what are the vulnerabilities in big, big corporations. That's a big career, believe me. Very paying.
But it's really interesting because I've also looked into it too, like cybersecurity. Like I always watch movies. I think there was this movie called Snowden. And so it was a lot about security and hacking. Like there was this one scene where he put his phone, like everyone's phone, in the microwave and the radio frequency. So it's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I feel like every job also has its own, like, you know, challenges to face. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it is very. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, please go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, yeah, it is very interesting. And there's a lot of positions to choose from in this one area.
But I think for everything, you know, you need to understand a few basic things that, you know, you have to understand what your threats are, where they are, how the hackers are thinking. And then you should also understand what's the good citizen behavior on cybersecurity that you should have. And rest of it, it's not as glamorous as it sounds, like short Schroeder's movie, but well, it's a career. It's a very nice.
Yeah. So now we wanted to discuss a little bit about your company, Frictionless Security. So when and what motivated you to start your own company?
Right. So what happened was I was coming to the fag end of my career. I've been working for 36 years or so. So I wanted to say bye to my corporate career. So I did that 2 years back, voluntarily. This time, nobody asked me to leave. I was doing actually fantastic with KLA and everything was great. But then I said, you know, I should say bye when I am doing very well, rather than, you know, somebody says that, you know, that's... So that was the internal motivation. Externally, I just wanted to do something different. So I said, okay, let me do something which I think would be beneficial for the industry. So one thing I observed when I was doing my job at KLA, we had a lot of vendors who were working with us, and vendor risk is one vector. Vendor is one vector which is bringing a lot of risks. But these vendors are of different types, you know, like there are some big vendors, there are some very small ones, there are some very new ones, startups and so on. And we were trying to mitigate the risk which is coming from their side. So for example, if my previous company wanted to have a vendor who was in HR space, for example, human resource, and they were providing a particular service benefits, for example, we would do the evaluation and we'll say that what kind of risk they can bring in. So maybe when we share data with them, there could be a risk for the data. If we share our infrastructure, there could be some attack vector from there. If we share our user ID password, there could be some problem. So likewise. But I realized that these people are, some of them know about security very well. Some of them are not. Some of them are like any other spectrum, normal distribution. So, but the thing was that we were so busy that we were not able to coach them. And so I said, you know, just to make this friction less friction, we need to create some sort of framework which is beneficial from both the sides. So we call it TPRM, third party risk mitigation, which is a standard term used by corporation. But it is generally done at the procurement level or at the information security level, which is kind of one of the essential evil state thing. There's very little opportunity for any security guy in an organization to help these vendors. So I said, let me help these vendors. So we created what we call VQTPRM. And our theory is that, so VQ is vendor qualification. So if you are a vendor, for example, and you want to work with, say, IBM, and all you get is a 900 question, long questionnaire to fill, and you have no guidance, you will say, what is this? You know, my core competence is not to answer this 900 questions. I am creating a service which is, you know, cutting edge digital transformation. You know, you are all gung-ho on that. And then you have to go through these gates, which are totally alien to you. So it becomes very difficult. So that's where we are trying to help there. And also to help general awareness of security. Security also got some bad press, if you like. The bad press is that they are always trying to stop things, right? So there's a lot of friction which is inherent. I mean, you try to prevent something. If you break, you are not accelerating, right? I mean, it's like two different functions. So if somebody is constantly asking you to break, then you say, then how am I going to drive? You feel constrained, right? And especially the millennials and the later generation, if you ask them not to do something, it is very difficult. You know, it's like they say, don't try to control me, don't try to boss me. You know, and it doesn't happen. So it's a lot of friction. And how to do frictionless security is an art. So I, in all my wisdom, I thought that we have, and I've got a couple of other like-minded people in the company. So we thought that if that is the case, then why don't we create a service for these people? So it's happening very well. I'm also working on my own terms, so I don't have to be, doing corporate things that, you need to do, like attending meetings, doing approvals, supervising somebody. So I'm loving it. So that's what we are doing. It's a small organization. We are getting a lot of traction and recognition. So I'm speaking in public forums about it and professional forums about it, and very vocal about it. But that's what is happening right now in my life.
Yeah, I was going to say that's really unique. Like when you said frictionless is an art. So I was like, oh, I haven't really thought about it that way. Because like when I was looking at the name too, my dad was just saying like you should talk about frictionless security. You know, I wasn't really, understanding like why frictionless, and it's really unique, the name as well.
So I should tell you that I did not use this term. I was not an inventor of this term. It just has been there. There's a book called Frictionless, very nice book. And this concept has been there in the industry, but in the context of security, broad term, that's how we are using it. So frictionless has been used for user ID password, authentication. That you open your laptop and somebody authenticates or some process authenticates in the background, and you don't have to type in your user ID password. That was the first time frictionless was used in the context of security. But we are using it in a broader term. So for us, complexity is not the only factor, or some sort of break in the process or change in the process is not the, it's a combination of the overall thing. So if I put a control which is less emotionally abrasive to you, to the extent that it is happening automatically, all that is part of friction. So that's why it's an art, that you can tell somebody not to do something, but in such a way that they follow. So, and you not always tell people not to do something, you tell them what to do, what to do, which will make them secure and which will make their operations. So anyway, it's an art.
yeah, same. I also like the name. It's very unique. I also had a question. Do you have any customer success stories you would like to share with our listeners, like the result of working with their company?
Right. So there's one story which I always tell, which happened only last year. So I had this person come to me through my contacts, and he said that he's stuck with this big bank. Their TPRM process. And he said, I don't understand what they really need. because they have sent me this. And I said, this is very typical, because bank doesn't have time. So let me tell you one thing. You have to have a frictionless approach to this. So we created some sort of 3 or 4 step process for them. First step was don't panic. Now this sounds very cliche or very simple, but once you panic, then you know it's difficult to proceed further. So first of all, I told him, I said, I'll be hand-holding you, don't worry about it. I have gone through this process several times over last 7-8 years, and I understand it. I understand the pain points and what goes wrong and what doesn't go wrong. Now, the thing is that after you realize that somebody is holding your hand, it's at psychological level, you need some real support on the technical side. So I told him that, you know, the things that the bank is looking is basically they are trying to mitigate some risks there. They think that by bringing you, there will be some risks which are coming. Have you gone back to bank and asked them that what risks they are trying to mitigate? He said, no, I have not. I said, first pick up the phone, call the guy, ask them what risks they are mitigating. You know, rather than concentrating on the questionnaire, because once you understand what risks they are mitigating, then you can have a strategy for that. It is not about answering the questions, it's about having a strategy. So when we sat down with him and I was in the call, so I was supporting him, then I started asking. First of all, this guy was very appreciative on the bank. He said, nobody has ever asked me this question. He said, no vendor has come back and asked me this question. And he said, it's very funny because I don't know how they are presenting themselves, because they never asked this question. I said, but you know, you should have a paper. Say, this is the risk that we are trying to mitigate. Now, with this conversation, the bank started putting that document together. They called me later on, said, you know, help us in articulating it. So we articulated it from the perspective of vendors, how they can understand it on one side. On the other side, I was helping this vendor to go through that process. Once you know both the sides and you know what they're trying to do, it became easier for me to do the work. So this guy was estimating it will take about 4 months for them to go through the whole process. We shortened that period for about, you know, 3 weeks max, I would say. So the guy was saying that, hey, I save a lot of money, so how can I help you? I said, you introduce me to 3 or 4 more persons and tell them this story. So the guy is now going around and telling this story on my behalf to all the people, and I'm getting more business. I have got at least 2 more customers because of that. So you know, this is my little success story.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's a good story. And you also got help to grow your company too. So it's a
business.
Also I tested my framework so now I've got at least 3-4 you know live cases out of that.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any advice for future entrepreneurs doing something unique in the cyber security field?
Yeah, I got several things for the new entrepreneurs, and I see hundreds and thousands of them are coming into this space of, you know, entrepreneurship, and they are getting good funding. They have got good ideas. Some ideas are kind of very novel and very, you know, very beneficial for the whole society. But there are a few things which I want to tell them from security perspective. One is that security is by design. It's not an afterthought. So when you are configuring a product and you are working on it, especially if it's a technical product and you are doing DevOps, please think about DevSecOps. It is very simple to have security inbuilt your development and operations, you know, processes from the start. So if you go on my LinkedIn, I have got a couple of articles where I have illustrated through different, you know, objects in nature, Mother Nature, that, you know, controls which are upfront are easier than the controls which are down the line. So it is very interesting. I was walking in one of the trails, and they have got these big pipe, tubes in the water reservoir, you know. And I was looking at it, saying that, you know, and a lot of debris was there, you know, it was getting collected. And I was looking at it, and I was saying this is a beautiful control, because all this debris which would have clogged the channels later on is kind of caught upfront. But then when I went there one day, I saw that one guy was, you know, bending down and picking something from the spout, which is the water is going out. And so I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm collecting all the debris which you know, comes here despite of all the controls that we have got. And I said, but it's very dangerous. He said, not only is it dangerous, it's also very difficult to, you know, work, because, you know, only you can do, there's no machine which can. go there. So you have to lower a human on a string, and then this guy is going there picking it up. Anyway, the long and short of it is that controls upfront are easier than the down. So you have to think about the controls which are easier when you are developing a product. Second thing is that always think about the product that security is a unique selling proposition. If you have to buy two products in the market, one has got good security, other doesn't have good security, you'll go for the one which has better security. So security is now no longer an essential evil nowadays. It is a demand. People are asking for it. So when Zoom was becoming popular, for example, the consumers asked for the security. And then they had to put the security. They spent a lot of money on that. Had they thought about it early on? You know, it's an academic issue. But so these are some of the things that I would like to tell.
Yeah, definitely. These are good advice. And it's very true. Like, people want security now these days. Like, these days,
yeah.
Everyone feels, threatened, or like, they want some kind of security. So it's for sure. I would like security and whatever I'm using.
Yeah, so we wanted to start discussing a little on CS impacts on society. So global cyber threats and crimes are increasing day by day and becoming a huge problem in society today. What is your perspective on countries, individuals, syndicates engaging in cyber attacks? So some recent examples are ransomware, SolarWinds hack, and etc. So do you want to share some thoughts?
So cyber crime is very rewarding. It has been always rewarding, but never like what currently is happening. And it will only grow because it has become not only a syndicated crime. There are no more, code junkies sitting somewhere and trying to, just hack for the fun of it. It has become like an organized crime and also organized espionage from, state perspective. So you will see more and more countries, more and more syndicates, more and more, cliques that are coming. And I don't know whether you guys have seen this Indian web series called Jamtara. If you have not, then you should watch it. It is about a place in Bihar called Jamtara, where the people are so savvy, and they are forming a lot of attacks from there. In fact, all the attacks that are originating from India, about 60-70% were from this small town called Jamtara. So it got this ill fame. Anyway, I have met some of the hackers and some of the people who are they are good hackers and they are some bad hackers. And there are people who go to conferences where all these hackers come and so on. So so there's it is no more like about fame or about certain, I would say, some people were hacking early on because they had some theory or some sort of a kind of forum, and they thought like for example environmentalists, there were some who were really became wild and they started attacking corporations. But the ransomware that you are seeing right now, that is something which is very rewarding because people do what they do, and they are not very careful. And ransomware is very easy attack to configure. And right now, what is happening is that there are a lot of channels which are open. It's not only email, which is a vulnerable channel for ransomware. And another thing is that the people who are attacking are actually much more knowledgeable and much more skilled than I am. I have no qualm by saying that. These people are really, they master their art and they are very smart. The only difference is that they are on the crime side and we are on the good side. But we are all working, most of the time we are working individually. We don't have a big consortium where we are. Let me back up. I will say it with a pinch of salt because there were no consortium earlier. Now there are, and they are more and more, and there should be more and more. But these people are really funded. They are well funded. They are people who are investing in them and so on. So you will see more of those attacks. Also, they are finding new patterns, attack patterns, and new vulnerabilities. And our softwares were developed over the years that those softwares have really got some vulnerabilities, and people are not updating and patching their software. It's difficult. It's not easy. And this is like one of the hygiene factors. And also, people are carrying a lot of data with them. Just think about it. You go to your locker and take out all the stuff that you have got, put it in the suitcase, and then you are walking around with that suitcase. That's what our laptops are. Our laptops have got all the data, which is essential for us to, or even the mobile. Think about it. We carry our mobile. Mobile is our identity. It's our portal. It's our, we have got so much of there. And sometimes it is not as protected as it should be. And people know how to attack it. They will attack. So beware. This is going to increase. There are organizations in China, Russia, and China, Russia is not the only countries. There are the whole lot of Eastern Bloc countries, and when we blame others, we should look into our attack patterns. There are many attacks which have originated from US, and allegedly funded by either some agencies which were known to the government or government by themselves. So what I'm saying is everybody is trying to use cyber attack as a weapon. And now you young people are coming up, and you should take care of it and say, hey, I take responsibility. It should not be used like that, and so on. But we are now exiting, but you guys are entering in the career.
Yeah, of course. No, yeah. I was gonna add on by saying, like, there was a recent WhatsApp hack, and my parents and friends and family, they all got some link, and then they thought it was like, just a link to some TikTok or some article to read. But turns out when they clicked on it, it just glitched. And then it was definitely a hack. And I also saw on the news too, like a lot of people couldn't get back into their accounts, and they've been framing them, give me money, and then putting passwords. So it's super hard. Like as you said, Mr. Mathur, it's like they're super smart. Even we can't figure out what are they doing, like the psychology.
If you like, I can tell you four or five small steps that you should take before clicking anything. One very simple thing. I mean, this is all grandmother's talk. So it is nothing new. So like grandmother always tells you that, you should verify who the person is who is talking to you, right? Very simple. The same thing is that when you click, before you click, you should have two checks. One is that who that person is, what the person's intention is, and how do you know that person is who that person is claiming to be? These are two simple checks, because we don't authenticate at the gate. And then when you don't authenticate and we assume, then funny things happen. And people have got very interesting way of psychologically, overpowering, the victim. One thing is the lure, so my wife got a note saying that PG&E is overcharged, and they are going to refund $23.50, and please click here to give your details and so on. And she came to me and said, oh, PG&E is very good there. So I said, I just asked one question. I said, how do you know this is from PG&E? She said, oh, she looked at it and she said, no, but it says PG&E something.com. I said, PG&E something.com? We should investigate. And we investigated, of course. But the point is that the moment you said, oh, refund, you said, okay, let me get it. Or somebody as simple as that if you don't click on this, there'll be some bad luck coming to you. And believe me, some people fall for it. Or it says that if you send it to seven people, then, good fortune will come your way. And people do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to blame them. But what I'm saying, that people are, playing their sentiments or emotions. And sometimes they become very authoritative. So they have mastered this art. And then the thing is, they also use, so if you see that it's Microsoft.com, and the O, if you look at it, actually not O, it is O with two dots on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they, all sorts of tricks. So the point is that if you know that who they are, and if you know some way to authenticate them, then you are at least one level safer. Then second thing is that, why do you want to click on it?
Yeah, exactly.
There for you. I mean, are you just doing it because somebody is asking you to do, or are you under somebody's spell or something? I mean, why are you clicking? Then third thing is that do you indiscriminately open the door when you go to somebody's house? You don't. There has to be some reason for you to click, right? So what's your reason? Motivation is one thing, but what's your reason? When you ask these questions, 90% of the clicking goes away.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was going to add on. Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Mathur.
I'm just saying that you have to be responsible. When you click something, it is an action that you are taking, right? You are exiting and going somewhere else, right? You don't open the door without looking, you know, down whether there's something there or you are just jumping off the cliff.
So, right. Yeah, I was going to say that it's also hard for like older people too. Like my grandparents, they don't know how, like, you know, technology. It's just, you know, small things they know, but like they don't know, like, oh, like, should I touch on this link? Like, they don't know those types of things. And like, they've also made those mistakes in the past. We have to, like, as children, we have to tell them, like, don't touch on this link. And they're like, wait, that's a thing? Like, that's a thing? And I'm like, yeah, it's a thing. So definitely it's hard for old people, old generations.
Yeah, this is your responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, we, and also, like, you know, we also download a bunch of these blockers on, you know, on a Chrome or something. Like, you know, I have, like, you know, ad blockers or these other blockers. So it's getting really, like, it's increasing, as you said, and it's very, you have to be very careful. And like, there's also a recent, like, TikTok thing, right? Everyone is saying, like, oh, they might be stealing your data or privacy.
Yeah,
so there's
a
whole thing if it was, whether it's going to be banned or not.
It got banned in India, because of
but,
it,
like,
security.
Yeah, it's going on still here. I guess it's all right now, but yeah, it's everywhere.
But one thing that, you know, the younger generation should understand is that anybody who is creating infrastructure and providing a service for you will not do it for free. So anything that is free, like, no, I'm not blaming Facebook or, but I'm just saying anything which is, you know, free, like Facebook or Instagram or TikTok. I mean, they're all great programs, but you should understand why they're giving you free. I mean, there's nothing free. They have put so much of, so I do my updates here, and in India, the update happens in microseconds. Like, within 1 second, the application takes place. And it's going. So as an IT professional, I know how much infrastructure they have put in there. So they are not doing it for free. So they, you want to use your data. That's for sure. Now, how much data you give and what format you give is up to you, because you are in control. Don't feel helpless about it, because you are in control. And if you are sharing your data fully well, you know, aware and so on, and you think that no harm is going to come, by all means, go ahead and share it. I mean, there's nothing wrong in it. But if you think that there's some harm which may come to you, then hey, be careful. Your grandmother was always right. She always is right, and she will always be right.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, everything is, like, you're just selling your data. And sometimes, like, when I go on an article, like, that's a scientific article, the first thing says, do you want to accept cookies? And I'm like, please close this. And, like, I never want to press OK, because I think there's, like, this documentary called The Social Dilemma. I don't know if you've watched it, Mr. Mathur, but that really explains, like, everything, how, you know, they're using you, you're selling your data, it's all online, and life and endangering your life. So they really explain that really well too,
right? But then the flip side of it is that don't get scared because of that. The thing is that that's a fact of life. So now as a student, as you said, you have two choices: either not to do research online or you do research in a cautious way, right? So which will you use? So you use the cautious way. So what I'm saying is that we should not get scared of the new way of doing things. There's no way this is the new order. It's going to be there. When I was doing research, when I was your age, you know, we had libraries, physical libraries, which has physical catalog, you know, like, and the books were like physically borrowed. And I tell you the pain of that. In a small town where I was doing my MBA, there was only 2 copies of Harvard Business Review coming. And all us kids, we would go there and go at 7 o'clock in the morning when this SBR was coming there and try to borrow it. Those are the times. To the time now that you can get any article anytime on demand and so on. So, you know, it's a bliss. It's a boon. But you have to be careful how to use it. That's about it. Nothing else.
Yeah, it's a blessing too for like Generation Z, especially like even in my parents' generation, you know, 90s and stuff like that, in the 1970s, 1980s and so forth, like in the old generation or like my parents' generation. I think there's like a specific term for this, but I forgot. Mega, do you know the term? there's boomers and there's like, yeah, I forgot. It's like, yeah. Escaping my mind. Yeah, so I was just saying, like, my parents used to tell me, like, you know, you're so lucky you have, you know, you can go, you can check anywhere, search anything, like how to study, the effective methods to like remember faster. So many resources online. And then when it was in my parents' generation, when they said, they also say, like you said, Mr. Ma, like going to the library, you know, we only had few textbooks, we could only rely just on books for studying for a test. Like, there's nothing online, no like escaping, you know. But for us, it's like we can check online, we can check books, we have so many stuff, so many things. Definitely,
you have to clean your cookies, you have to make sure, you know, somebody is stealing your information.
exactly
It's a completely different world from like parents' generation and our generation, and who knows the future generation, like how it's gonna be. Yeah, like when we're older, we're gonna be like, oh wow, like what is this, you know. So we wanted to wrap this episode with AI impacts in CS and CS as a profession. So so many jobs are becoming automated these days, do you think all cybersecurity work will eventually be taken over by automation and AI?
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, that's a fear which people have, that AI will kind of consume this whole thing. And there would be an effect. There's no doubt about it. There are so many things that, you know, artificial intelligence can do much better than humans can do. But and this is a general statement, not only in computer science or in just cybersecurity. But the important thing is that cybersecurity is going to get benefited by AI in a big way. Attacks are happening in the speed of light, you know, and humans cannot compare the speed of you know. I was very amazed with all this. The new IP address, you know, the bigger one. There's so many IP addresses which are coming and going on the speed of light, that the hackers are hiding behind that. They are creating IP address, doing something, going away. Another IP address, do something, go away. You can't trace them. This particular thing, this phenomena is so rampant nowadays that no human can match that. I'm just giving one example, but there are hundreds of examples. They call it V factor. So you have got velocity, you have veracity, you have got volume. So there are many factors. So attacks are getting into this V form. You know, they are just going exponentially in all dimensions, if you like. And we are talking about at least 5-6 dimensions. So AI is something which can happen very fast, which can do the pattern analysis of these 6-7 dimensional hyperspace in a much better format. And so humans have to rely on AI. And AI has to rely on humans to give them the kind of, you know. So all the learning, which is, they say, unsupervised learning, is great. But then I don't believe that everything can be unsupervised learning, that these programs can learn all by themselves and become so powerful that they replace all the roles that we talked about, the threat analyst, the security analyst, the security architect, the design person. And its security is not something that is very, you know, it's all about technology. It is about technology, people, and process. And artificial intelligence so far has not, it has improved technology and it's improved process. But when it comes to people, it has not helped that much. Although one day I want to learn from an AI engine. I'm living that day. Hopefully I'll get that in my life.
Definitely.
I have not seen that happening. So there are certain roles which will still be there, but most of the mechanical or most of the mundane work will go away. So for a person to look at 10 screens and trying to decipher what is going on is a very tedious job and a very slow job. By the time you find out what's happening, the attack has already manifested. So that will be helped to a great degree by AI. So there will be, in future, there will be cybersecurity AI assistants, cybersecurity AI, avatars, and you may name them, you may call one Linda, another one you may call Jill, whatever. But these will be the AI people who will be helping you. And I hope that I'm still there by getting help by Jill and Linda. I mean, I don't know, but I'm just saying that. So I don't believe that all the jobs will be gone, and but there will be new jobs coming in cybersecurity area, and constantly we are getting new and newer roles. Some of them are very interesting now. Some of them are very glamorous. Some of them are very mundane. So yeah.
I was gonna say that, you know, AI has always fascinated me as a person too. Like, you know, I watch movies, I've seen it on the news. I think Sophia the robot, like Alexa, for example, and like even my family's, because we always put on Alexa on mute because, you know, you never know if it's listening to your conversation. So like, I just turned it on because we never turn it. We don't even talk anymore to Alexa anymore. I don't know what happened after like a year, just been sitting there. And like yesterday, we were just, my sister and I were testing something on Alexa and we turned it on. And my mom's like, did you mute the microphone like on Alexa? I'm like, what's going to happen just this one time? So definitely, I think AI is really interesting. And, you know, the field is growing too. There have been a lot of applications as well, like super interesting. And you haven't even thought about them, but like, oh my God, these geniuses actually, you know, thought of the idea connecting with AI too and make our life easier as well.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say the similar thing. It's really fascinating. And yeah, it's also kind of weird how they can be, you know, I have a Google Home and they can be listening every single time. Sometimes it just goes off. I'm like, oh, wait, I didn't even say you. Like, wait, what's happening? Like, it's kind of, you know, kind of scary in that part. And like, as you said, there'll be movies and stuff. There are movies about this. And, you know, there's people are scared that, you know, AI will take over the world. Like, there's like a lot of people like, you know, theorizing that, like, you know, future, like, robots and stuff will take over humanity.
Exactly.
But on that note, let me share some of the things that we thought when we were students like you, that they are going to happen in the world, but which did not happen in the last 30, 40 years. One was that when I was a student, they always talked about getting things, you know, printed in a 3D format. And it took 35 years before it became a reality, and that too in a very partial way, I would say. Second thing was that we always dreamed that there would be an opera happening in front of us on the table, 3D projection from the ceiling. And in 1985, I saw first demo of it. And I thought this is going to be the reality, you know, like this is going to be the reality very soon. It never happened. Paperless office was talked about when I was a student, that there will be no paper in the office. Today, I buy more paper than ever. I don't know why. I mean, you ask, I can't explain it. But I'm saying that there are paperless offices, but they are very few and far in between. Then they talked about artificial intelligence. Everybody, you know, is going to be, you know, kind of like colonizing the space and, you know, living there. And but, I mean, these are the things which happen. Some of the dreams come true, like this mobile phone, which we used to see in the Star Trek. I don't know whether you know about it. There was a Sci-Fi. And the guy used to flip the phone and you know, talk, and we saw it. We used it. So there are a few things which happened, but few things did not happen.
I like Star Trek too, the show.
Yeah, I mean, we have no idea what our future is going to be like. Like, maybe nothing like this will happen, or maybe something like this will happen.
Definitely. Yeah, I was going to say that, moving on. Yeah, so my next question was, how can one start a profession in computer science or cybersecurity? And do you have any advice or like any prerequisites in order to become a successful cybersecurity professional? Like, I know, like, I'm interested in CS too. And I know, like, you know, you should know programming languages, you should know this, you should know the ABCD of the computer, everything. So do you have any thoughts to share on that?
Right. So my first thought is, and I want to tell all the youngsters who are getting, you know, inspiration in terms of going into this field. One is that you only choose this if you really want to do it, because this is not an easy job or easy profession. That's one thing. Second, and why I say so, because, you know, there are a lot of demands on security guys. So you may be working in an organization where you know, the core activity is whatever. Core activity is, for example, digital transformation, and you are part of the core team, then it's one thing. But there are very few companies where the core activity is information security. Information security is always like a role in an organization that is a difficult one, because business has got some demands on it, and technical teams have got demands on it, and you are kind of, you know, trying to balance. So there's a lot of balancing act. So there's a lot of maturity which is required. In terms of prerequisite, you should be, we think that technology is a major portion of information security. Actually, I would say it's only maybe 30-40% of it. So one side of it is, it's all, you know, about identifying the risks and articulating it and trying to understand the risk. It's more like business management from that side. From the other side, it's managing people. So it's very much people-centric thing that you have to deal with people rather than dealing with technology. So for example, if I say that, from now on, you girls can only come or visit the site through VPN and put VPN there, right? And so I'm not dealing with putting VPN. That's probably a half an hour job. My biggest job is to convince you guys that you should use VPN, and it's useful and so on. So what I'm saying is that information security is not about sitting and coding. Although sometimes you are doing that, you are writing scripts, you are writing, and if you are doing investigations, if you are doing this, then you have a lot of technical in-depth work which is required. But most of it is a mixture of all those things. So you may be doing some implementation where you are sitting and implementing like any other IT work. So you are doing that. Sometimes you are dealing with, beefing up the control and trying to find out why it's working, why it's not working. You are doing, a lot of management work and so on. And project management is one part, which is always there. Because you are doing things in a controlled environment that you are going from one stable state to another stable state. And that requires a lot of skills. And so I would say have a good technical background, because everything is technical nowadays. So that's it. Second thing is that come in this field if you are really interested in it, if the hacking really interests you, and if you are very interested in knowing that how you can defend yourself from the... So it's almost like saying that, are you motivated to join the police or the fire brigade? Or, some people are, some people are not. Some people say, hey, this is not for me. So you should understand that it's almost like joining fire brigade or joining police, depending upon which side of information security you are. If you are in compliance, then you are like a police. If you are going like a incident, responder or first responder, then you are like fire brigade, and you have to be on your toes. So 3 o'clock in the morning when an attack happens and you get a call and the escalation comes to you, what you should do when your dog is barking and your kid is crying. I mean, these are questions that you have to ask yourself. And so if you are happy with that, then by all means, this is a very growing field. We have got a lot of shortage. Believe me, for me to get a good information security person or cybersecurity professional is an uphill battle. And there are some very good professionals overseas, but to get a person who can do the work at the right time is very difficult. So I would encourage all the kids to look into it. This is a job, this is kind of a job which you can get very easily. If you are competent, you can get your, and you, the jobs are very well paying. An analyst job, for example, it starts with something like $120,000, $150,000. I mean, in Silicon Valley, it may be a common talk, but if you go to places like, Midwest or South, it's a lot of money. Right? So
definitely.
So just be inspired, and but be careful that, this is a field which requires, and it also requires a lot of guts. You may get the same amount of money in some other profession. But this profession, really, you have to be on your ground firmly and fighting your fight in the sky, and be very bold, and which is what all the young generation is. So I am very confident that you guys are much bolder than I was at your age. So
yeah, I was gonna say, we're right here in the Silicon Valley, and it's like literally the tech hub in California. So definitely it's so competitive, like every single person, like even my friends, they just graduated high school. It's like most of my friends are doing computer science in like SDSU or like other universities. So I definitely, I relate, because it's super competitive too. And like, as you said, Mr. Mata, you need guts, you need confidence. At the end of the day, it's like when you get into it, it's like, how skilled are you and how smart are you and matters. And, can you battle, the fight, and can you fight and, go beyond? And so definitely.
For any profession, but for CS profession, it's very much. You really need to, you should not get, swayed by events which are happening, because events are happening all around you. So just to give you an anecdote, when I joined KLA after my joining, about maybe 20 days, and our data center was down. And so we did not know whether it was a security event or not. So I was called, and I was sitting there, and I had no idea about the infrastructure. I was very new about it, the whole thing. But I was there, and I had to do what I was supposed to do. and I had very little information and so on. But like all other people in my team, and nobody was kind of, you know, flinched or you know, was very sad or feeling defined about it. We all fought and we just got the data center up. And you may say that it was just, you know, by sheer, you know, valor, but it was more than that, because you know, need knowledge, you need technology, you need everything. You know, so but such things happen. So.
Yeah, definitely. And like, also, you should be definitely passionate about it. If you're passionate about it, you'll be happy about it and be easier for you too. I wanted to ask you, like, this field, like, you know, dominated by men. So like, what can we do to encourage more diversity in this field? I know, like, my dad was saying, like, you know, they're encouraging more women to work in his office.
Right. So, I mean, it starts from the grassroots level. So first of all, we have to tell the girls who are in the middle school, in the primary school and so on, that they can do the job which man can do. There's nothing in the, I mean, this is a myth that, you know, women should not do, you know, jobs like cybersecurity and so on. That's totally wrong. That's first thing. Second thing is that the girls should also go into STEM, you know, the science curriculum. That's very essential. I mean, and you know, when I say this, my you know, personality is more artistic. I do a lot of, you know, you can see my artwork on the wall and so on. And you can also see my degrees. So I do both for the sanity. Before this meeting, when I was waiting, I just made this small, you know, this guy. This doesn't mean anything. This is an asymmetric, you know.
That's nice.
Wow. Yeah.
But I do this all the time. So what I'm saying is that I'm not saying that, you know, a girl, because she is more artistic by nature, should not come in cybersecurity. That's totally wrong. And girls are very strong. They are stronger than that's another topic. But but the point is, they should get the right opportunities. So one thing is that they should come in the STEM. That's one thing. Second thing is that they should pursue their career in high tech, digital transformation, and so on. These are kind of things which most of the girls, they don't do. They do the high school and then they try to do the. I mean, I'm not generalizing. I'm just saying that's the path for them to take any other profession is easier. And they just go. They don't do graduation, post-graduation, or do that rigor which is required. But I'm saying that when a boy can study for 16 years, why can't a girl study for 16 years? There's no reason except a self-defeating thing, then it's a different thing, but there's no reason. So we have to encourage girls, first of all. And second of all, so when I was working, again, going back to my last job, there was one intern who came in there, and she was very bright. She was brighter than me, brighter than my boss. I'm not complimenting her, but that's how she was. And she took my position, in the sense that when I left, she was the one who was doing most of the work. So she was an intern to start with. But what I'm saying is that generally, and also my own interaction, I have seen that girls are very smart, and they are coming in this field. You are right that they are less in numbers, and there should be more. And in fact, you guys should help me to encourage the industry to take more girls in there.
Yes, of course. We're also like women advocates. We're like, you know, we can do anything. And that's kind of the reason we started this podcast. Oh yeah, Mr. Mathur, you're like the first male guest we've had on our show. So it's all women. So we are also strong supporters of like feminism. You know, we should, you know, as Omega said, there's less women in the STEM field and not many women are going to be, they're like, oh yeah, there's like, I mean, like there are other jobs too, right? So definitely, because some, I think I have a few friends, they're like, oh, I'm not interested in, you know, technology. Like, you know, so you should have a passion. And, you know, I've also seen like so many like women too, especially, they're like really skilled and really smart. And they're like really competitive too, when you compare it to like men. So like everyone is equal, they have equal opportunities. So yeah, definitely.
There's nothing wrong in becoming a housewife. I mean, I'm right now more house husband than anything else, because I'm at home. I have my own company. So I work in the kitchen all the time. It's fine. What I'm saying is that, but that should not be the goal of your life. I mean, in order for you to survive, you have to be house husband or housewife. That is fine. But you need to have some passion. And if you have got passion in IT, AI, you know, ML or CS, you should pursue that. And then become a good housewife. Great. No problems.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we have to chase our passions for sure. Yeah, I think this is all we have. Did you want to add anything else?
No, nothing. I'm just, you know, I wish you all the best. You know, not only you, but through you, all the kids who are, you know, listening to this.
And yeah.
come to see us, better it is for us. So I encourage, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah. Before ending, can you give one last piece of advice to our listeners? And you can also, you know, shout out and promote anything you would like.
Right. So my only advice is that, you know, we are there is no escape from cyber security, cyber attacks, cyber, you know, and becoming a cyber citizen. In my opinion, there is something that we already crossed. We have to be, you know, we are there already. So we cannot go back. So the only thing we can do is to operate safely. So like when I left India and I came to Singapore, for example, I had certain, you know, norms that I will operate. And I'm still operating under those norms. And those norms are, in my mind, secure norms. So there is nothing like for me very different than, you know, that I'm pursuing right now. All my guiding principles are still the same. Whether I'm taking a journey by train or by plane, or I am taking a journey on cyberspace, my rules are the same. And believe me, they are the things that my grandmother taught me. So there's nothing more than that. Yeah, I'm more technical. I'm more savvy. I can use more jargons. I can use more terms, more tools and techniques. That's great. But most of it is very basic. So that's my advice. Just you know, you have to be there. So better take it as a career. Why not?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so Mr. Mathur, thank you so much for joining and sharing your experience with us, Mr. Mathur. So listeners, please check out Mr. Mathur's company website, www.frictionlesssecurity2s, for contact information and all cybersecurity services his company provides. So check out the link in description. And yeah, Mr. Mathur, thank you so much again for joining. I had a lot of, you know, I now know a lot more information about cybersecurity because I've been also very curious about it from like a long time ago. And when my dad said, you know, you can interview Mr. Mathur, so then I was like, yeah, definitely. And now I know a lot of information, and I actually now want a career in cybersecurity too. It looks interesting. But yeah,
definitely. Yeah, just to add on to what Varsha said, I didn't know much about cybersecurity either. So, you know, this interview, I learned so much more and a lot of advice. You gave so much advice to our listeners. So again, we will link everything down below. So
go check it out.
Thank you so much for joining, Mr. Mathur.
Have a great day, everyone. It's me, Varsha.
And Mega.
Signing off.